2474, Samsung Electric v. Allen. Cordell, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ruffin Cordell, may it please the court, I'm here on behalf of all appellants. This case presents a dispute over the proper approach to claim construction. We have appellees taking us back 15 years to the days of Texas Digital, and we're relying on extrinsic lay dictionaries that have generic definitions for application in a very highly specialized and technical field. For appellants' part, we are advancing a Phillips construction. We are looking at the definitions given to us by the patentee, both in the specification and in the prosecution history. And that really is the fundamental dispute of this case. What was perhaps most remarkable as I confirmed this appeal in reading the briefing is that in the blue brief, we advanced a very forceful, cogent, and I think persuasive argument that in response to an indefiniteness rejection.
Could you just stand up in front of us and tell me that in your blue brief you articulated a cogent, persuasive argument?
I'll just go with argument, Your Honor, if that'll do it.
Because the adjectives characterizing affirmatively your own quality of briefing seem not to be a good use of time.
Okay. Well, then I'll just call it an argument. We made a substantial argument. We can call it that. And in response, the red brief says nothing. So we've laid out for your honors that applicants suffered a 112.2 rejection on indefiniteness on the key term, substantially flexible substrate. In response to that rejection, the applicant gave us a definition for substantially flexible substrate. And in response, the red brief says nothing. And again, I won't characterize the argument because it's simply silent. But we have significant extrinsic record evidence here that gives us a definition of that term.
Did you say extrinsic or intrinsic?
Intrinsic, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Intrinsic evidence. So when we look at the specification, we have several instances where the term substantially flexible substrate is equated with thinning. And we can argue about the degree of thinning, but it happens over and over again in Appendix 885, column 8, lines 34 through 38. The thinned prin substantially flexible closed prin substrate. We have it again at Appendix 884, column 8, lines 45 through 50, the thinned prin substantially flexible closed prin substrate. Those examples were then reinforced in the prosecution history because when the examiner said substantially flexible was indefinite, it was vague, he couldn't figure out what it meant, applicants said the following. And this is at A10275.
Just to be clear, before we get to the prosecution history, is it your view that through lexicography in the specification, the patentee defined substantially flexible to be thinned to 50 microns or less in the spec?
Yes.
Yes? I thought you said we could pass on the degree to which it has to be thinned. I thought that the column 8 sites that you point us to had thinned and then in parentheses substantially flexible, but that none of those sites said thinned to 50 microns or less.
So there were others, Your Honor, at Appendix 882, columns 2, lines 65 through column 3, line 8, actually makes specific reference to thinning of the memory circuit to less than about 50 micrometers in thickness, forming a substantial.
Those references be lexicography. Lexicography is so it's setting forth a definition, correct? Definition of a term that's outside of its ordinary meaning.
Correct.
And here, it seems to me that there's a reference to the meaning as you find it throughout the specification. It doesn't say, it doesn't set out a clear, definite, new definition that's contrary or outside of the plain meaning of that term. So if it just references at large the specification, and of course, as you know, we have thousands of pages of the specification, how can that be lexicography?
I'll answer it in this way, Your Honor. We first have agreement by all the experts, both parties, that there is no plain accepted meaning for substantially flexible substrate in this art. So what we're talking about here is VLSI. We're talking about taking a wafer of mono, you know, monocrystalline silicon, and the question is that substantially flexible? What does that term mean? So imagine a slice of quartz, if you will. And the flexibility in the normal sense and the everyday sense doesn't really have a lot of application in that field. And that was agreed on both sides. And so we then resorted to the intrinsic record, to the specification of the prosecution history to come up with the proper definition. And the answer that I was about to summarize in response to the indefiniteness rejection was not just a reference, it was not an association, it was definitional. So the applicant was asked, what does this mean?
Is this definition at the expense of all of the possible definitions?
I think it is in that it was very clear. In fact, the applicant uses...
So there's a disavowal within this definition.
I think it is. I think that the applicant uses the term clear...
It's a clear and unmistakable disavowal. I don't see that. I don't see that passage that you're taking us through to be a clear and disavowal of all of the other definitions of a substantially thin.
Well, what the exact words utilized by the applicant here were clear and unambiguous. Now, they didn't say unmistakable, but the adjectives they used were clear and unambiguous, and they were doing it in a definitional sense.
You're now in the prosecution history, not the spec anymore. What page in the prosecution history would you like us to look at?
Yes, Your Honor. It's at Appendix 10275. This is the response to the office action.
You're going to have to start by telling me every time you cite this spec what volume, because you guys submitted, 13 or 14 volumes?
The last volume, right?
Yeah, 13.
Volume 13 out of 13.
What page?
10275.
So, I agree with you that this passage in 10.275 is your best evidence for something that is trying to define what substantially flexible means. But I guess what I'm concerned about, nevertheless, is even if I were to agree that substantially flexible for a substantially flexible substrate requires the substrate to be thinned to 50 microns or less, I'm not so sure that that necessarily displaces the notion of substantially flexible, also meaning its typical understanding of bendable without breaking. That is to say, the claim still requires, when it says substantially flexible, something that's bendable without breaking, and you get there with a substrate that's 50 microns or less.
So we would certainly be happy with a construction that says thin to 50 microns or less, such that it is bendable without breaking. That would be acceptable. What we can't do is simply ignore the definition that the applicant gave the patent office in order to secure allowance, made representations
right.
to
and
the patent.
There are a couple other places in the prosecution history where the applicant was communicating to the examiner that the prior art did not teach the substantially flexible substrate because those prior art teachings were rigid substrates, unlike the claimed flexible substrate. So there, you know, it's quite clear to me that the applicant was communicating to the agency that substantially flexible is also understood in its ordinary sense, bendable without breaking.
Well, so with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that what that does is it simply leaves open the question of how we decide whether something is rigid versus flexible in this art. So again, recall we're talking about a wafer of quartz, of silicon, monocrystalline silicon. The notion that it is bendable without breaking is not something that an everyday definition really applies to. I note that Appellees picked one definition out of the set. I mean, the thing that undid Texas Digital was the practice of choosing the definition that best suited a particular party's interests. And the other definitions out of dictionary at A15-365, that's in volume 13, could have been pliable, it could have been manageable, it could have been adaptable, it could have been variable. And yet they picked, you know, essentially bendable, which I don't think has, there's certainly nothing in this record to suggest that a wafer and protect, and what we're really talking about here is a chip. We're talking about a very small piece of a wafer is bendable in any sense. And so the suggestion that that definition would apply versus the one they gave us in the specification and in the prosecution history, where they called it, you know, they said with respect to the language substantially flexible, the meaning of this phrase as used in the claims is clearly explained in the specification, and they give us a site. And that site is the one that I read to Judge Moore a few moments ago.
So, Counselor, is that a clear expression of an intent to redefine the term?
I guess the difficulty I'm having, Your Honor, is that it's not redefining the term, it's defining it. There is no definition in this art for substantially flexible substrate. We've all agreed about that, or at least there's been no evidence.
But I don't understand why Judge Reyna and Judge Chen's points aren't right, given that what you say in this clearly explained part is, as described in this passage, a semiconductor substrate is caused to be substantially flexible by thinning it to 50 microns or less. So they're still, even here, focusing, as Judge Chen had mentioned earlier, on causing flexibility. And what does flexibility mean? You know, I don't know if this is definitional so much as explaining that here is how we can make something substantially flexible if you're starting with a standard silicon wafer, which is what they're starting with in this particular case.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I'm burdened with what they said. So they chose this as their definition. It may be imprecise.
But you can't just say the conclusion. They chose it as their definition. I think that what I'm struggling with is whether this expression is definitional or not.
They say so. They say the meaning of this phrase, as used in the claims, is clearly explained in the specification, including, for example, at page 18, lines 1
through 3. Then it goes on, as described in this passage, a semiconductor substrate is caused to be substantially flexible by thinning it to 50 microns or less and polishing or smoothing the thinned substrate to relieve stress. Just so I understand, is it your view that the polishing and smoothing contributes to the flexibility?
Yes.
So you have to have both thinning to 50 microns or less and polishing or smoothing under your definition.
I think that's debatable. I think you could probably stop at the less than 50 microns limitation. I think we were trying to remain very true to what they told the patent office, and the reference there to page 18, columns lines 1 through 3 is to. The patent, volume 2, appendix 886, at column 9, 3 through 7. And I'll read it. Grind the backside or exposed surface of the second circuit substrate to a thickness of less than 50 micrometers, and then polish or smooth the surface. The thinned substrate is now a substantially flexible substrate. So that's the reference that they pointed to that they said is the definition of this term.
Doesn't that just tell you how to get too substantially flexible?
It does.
Process to use?
It does, but it gives me several important clues as to the definition of the term, that it's less than 50 microns and that the thinned substrate is now a substantially flexible
substrate. Is that saying that there's no other way to do this?
We are not asking for a process limitation here. We don't request that the court's construction include.
The problem is that this paragraph that you're pointing us to is not definitional because it's describing a process.
Well, Your Honor, that is the definition they chose. They described it in somewhat process terms, but again, we're not asking.
Why isn't it fair to say, are there any other ways of doing this?
I think there are other ways, and I think they would be covered if the end result was less than 50 microns.
Can I ask you something? I've been through all of the claims at issue and all of these IPRs, and every one of them, if I were to import into these claims a low-stress dielectric requirement, maybe not 5 times 10 to the 8th, because that's a little absurd that you're trying to limit it to a particular number, but I recognize that some claims have that limitation expressly, others have low stress, others have substantially flexible circuit or substantially flexible die. But every single claim, as far as I can tell, if you are correct that a low stress dielectric is required, every single claim here has that limitation in it at issue in front of us, right?
That is correct. Under our construction, the LTSD...
Are there any claims in front of the district court? Because I understand there's a parallel district court litigation. To your knowledge, do the claims in front of the district court have the same limitations, or is it the case that this is only tangentially relevant?
No, I know that it is directly relevant. I know that many of the claims overlap. I don't know the answer as to whether all of them overlap, but certainly there is...
Before you go, because I know we're running out of time here, the other passage in the prosecution history that I think is helpful for you is JA16038 in the same volume.
Yes.
This is the passage that talks about how the two features are required to achieve substantial flexibility.
That's right, Your Honor. In the context...
For a circuit layer.
For a circuit
layer. Not the substrate, but for the circuit layer.
That's right.
Substantially flexible circuit layer.
I apologize for the complexity, but those are two distinct terms, similarly phrased, but two distinct terms.
And here, again, the applicant's communicating something to the agency and, by extension, the public. One is that the semiconductor material must be sufficiently thin.
That's right.
For example, 50 microns or less. Burton and Cato are believed to satisfy this requirement. The other is that the dielectric layer used in the processing semiconductor material must be sufficiently low stress. Otherwise, substantial flexibility is defeated.
Correct.
So, potentially, this could be read as understanding substantially flexible dies, substantially flexible circuit layers having two requirements.
Correct.
But again, it may still not yet completely displace what I think is also required with the end result property of something that's bendable but not without breaking.
If the requirements were conjunctive, we have no problem with that.
But I don't see how we wouldn't affirm here, because the claim construction ultimately rested on something that was bendable without breaking and which therefore did not accept your construction, which was narrowly just based on 50 microns or less.
Well, so my answer to that is because it's incorrect. So unless we have the 50 micron or less limitation, the construction is incorrect, and it informs the entirety of the rest of the case. So when we get to the obviousness analysis and we're talking about motivation to combine, the question is only relevant in view of the correct claim construction. We also have significant indefiniteness issues in this case that the board in somewhat surprising fashion was very clear about the fact that they weren't going to resolve the true claim scope. They sort of walked away quietly after doing what they felt was necessary in order to get us what we needed.
Let me make sure I understand. If I ultimately find that there's substantial evidence in the record to support the board's finding that there wasn't a motivation to combine Leedy with Burton or you, because either there wasn't a motivation or because there was no reasonable expectation of success, and I agree that substantially flexible should be understood to be something that's bendable without breaking, but also be a layer that's 50 microns or less, why wouldn't that result in a complete affirmance here of the board's decision?
Well, because again, the board's decision was done through the lens of their construction, which was different. And it's not really a question of whether it's narrower or broader, it was different. And the motivation to combine evidence was muddled in a different way, having to do with whether dielectrics are put down in a front end of line process versus back end of line process.
Yes, but I don't understand. The board found these claims under a broader construction than what Judge Chen, I think, is proposing and what you're saying you're agreeing to. Why would their decision necessarily be different if the construction was narrower?
Because the prior art is targeted toward that narrower construction. The prior art is targeted toward exactly what is shown in the patent. So we have a strange situation here in that the prior art forms the gravamen of the disclosure of the patents in suit. So we're not talking about a situation where we're taking prior art and we're arguing about whether it's similar or dissimilar. It's the same.
Are you not following? Yes, but you didn't make that argument below, which is your problem. Because you know what? I was all in on this case on the fact that Berlin is 30 microns or less. How can they say it's not substantially flexible? It has to be. It's 30 microns or less. But then I got to that portion of the board opinion where they say you expressly did not make this argument below and they're not going to give you that. And so I didn't know what the heck to do with that. And that's what I feel like you're trying to backdoor in right now.
Well, I'd like to
an argument you didn't make below.
I'd like to go through the front door on that one because I believe we
You should have gone through the front door on that before the board, but they expressly said you didn't make that argument.
Well, they have held that, but the reality is we did make that argument in the following sense. And this is as far as we needed to take it, which is that the prior
argument... You made it an oral argument for the first time in the oral hearing.
And they did deal with it in that sense. But I, with all due respect to the board, we did raise that argument previously, again, in a limited sense.
Can you show us where?
Yes.
It must be in the reply. It certainly wasn't in the petition.
It was in the reply.
Okay.
Because we didn't have the...
You didn't have the patent owner's counter-argument
exactly.
Until the response.
And
so
recall the way it unfolded
reply.
is the board went with us on our claim construction in the initial.
Yes. So where in the reply would that be?
Honor, I wonder if I could get it during the interim and bring
it back.
Okay,
that's fine. Let's hear from opposing counsel. Sir, how do I say your name?
Munier.
Mr. Munier, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So may it please the court, there was a lot of talk about claim construction. Let me just start out with, I think, what you've all been hinting at. Whether you change the claim construction or not doesn't affect that all of the claims being found valid by the board should be affirmed. Now, all but eight claims, we didn't talk really much about the dielectric, the low tensile dielectric limitation. All of the challenge claims except for eight have that express limitation of a low stress dielectric. They admitted that their primary art doesn't teach that limitation and they needed to combine the Burton 695 reference with one of the others.
Leedy,
yes.
Yeah, with Burton with Leedy. And
yes.
The board said that there was no reasonable expectation of success in taking that substrate and using the low stress dielectric with it.
It said that as well as there was no motivation to do it in the first place, that they had failed to meet their burden of proving either one of those facts.
So it's your argument then, as I understand it, that if there wasn't obviousness under a broader construction, how the heck could there be obviousness under a narrower construction if the reference didn't render obvious the broader construction, even if we read in a low stress dielectric to every single claim limitation, the board's fact findings remain that low stress dielectric there's no motivation to combine it and there's no reasonable expectation of success.
That's
it. Is that your argument?
That's one of them, Your Honor. That's it exactly. If they get, so again, if we focus on the ones that that actually have the dielectric, there were findings of fact. They don't even argue that they're not supported by substantial evidence. So they've lost on that issue. That they've lost on that you would combine Leedy to get the low stress dielectric. So all of the claims except for the eight that don't expressly say that, they've lost on.
But if we were to read those eight as requiring that because those eight all do have the substantially flexible circuit limitation, and if we were to read in to that substantially flexible circuit limitation a requirement of a low stress dielectric, then they've lost on that.
Right.
Too.
We obviously strongly disagree with
strongly
that claim
disagree,
construction.
But just
you're
say,
right. You're right.
Then the same argument would extend to those claims.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. But the argument that was also brought up that it sounded like all of a sudden now they agree that the construction should require some flexibility as opposed to it's thin to a certain amount and it's polished and it's
well,
got
in addition to
in addition to that, to that it's now got micro. Flexible. That's not only a new argument, but there was also already a finding of fact that they didn't teach, that they didn't prove that the prior art that they relied on teached a flexible substrate or a flexible circuit. All they, as was hinted at, all they tried to do was, and all they asked their expert to do was this substrate thinned and was it obvious to polish it? He was expressly requested not to consider whether it was actually flexible. And he testified, and the board relied on this, that if you wanted to figure out whether a substrate was actually flexible, whether a circuit was actually flexible, you can't just look at the dimensions. You can't just look at what their definition was. You have to look at a bunch of other factors, which they did not put any evidence in on. And I think it's important that none of the references that they point to actually talk about using a substantially flexible circuit, a substantially flexible substrate. None suggest it's a good thing to do.
No, but the references, like Burton, for example, discloses the exact same standard silicon semiconductor wafer, and it thins it to 30 microns or less. So it would inherently be substantially flexible if we're talking about just the substrate layer, because your patent says if you start with a standard silicon wafer, the exact same language that appears in Burton, standard silicon wafer, both your patent and Burton say the exact same thing. Let's start with a standard silicon wafer. In your patent, you say the substrate becomes substantially flexible if thinned to 50 microns or less. In Burton, they thin it to 30 microns or less. Hard for me to imagine if it's even thinner, it wouldn't be flexible.
Except that the board found as fact that mere thinning is not enough to make something flexible. Their expert testified that mere thinning is not enough to make something flexible.
It has to be polished.
No, there's other things you need to look at. You need to look at the material. You need to look at...
But the material's identical here. The material's identical. This patent discloses starting with a standard silicon wafer. That's the language in the patent. Burton says, let's use a standard silicon wafer. The material is identical. The expert identified material science type factors and the composition of the material that could cause it a different degree of flexibility based on how much things are thinned. But when you're starting with the exact same material, you can't have that difference.
But there's also the matter of, is it attached to a substrate that's rigid enough that's going to prevent it from flexing? So I would disagree with...
Attached to. You're talking about the circuit. I'm talking about the substantially flexible language as applied to the substrate.
That needs to be allowed to flex. But I think at essence we're agreeing, Your Honor, that they failed to prove and they failed to argue that there was actually any actual flexibility being taught by Burton, being taught by you, and that that's what the board found. At least that's what I think you're saying.
Burton was part of the prosecution, right?
Correct, Burton.
And then the patent owner distinguished its claims over Burton by arguing that Burton was a rigid substrate, unlike the claimed substantially flexible substrate, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The exact point where they're saying that there was a definition, which obviously we disagree with, the reference that was being distinguished over successfully was Burton.
Okay, can we go to JA16038?
Sure. Is that the...
That's the part that's where the, you say that Burton and Cato failed to teach or suggest the first or second circuit layer. And then it goes on in the prosecution history to explain that two features are required to achieve substantial flexibility.
Yes, Your Honor.
Otherwise, quote unquote, substantial flexibility is defeated. Let's assume for the moment I think that's definitional. Can you explain to me why I would be wrong?
I just want to make sure, I mean, is that 16039, Your Honor?
16038. It's in the last volume.
As I'm trying to get there, just to make sure I have the right language in front of me, I believe it's what's been discussed already. What's being discussed there is not a definition, and it's certainly not a definition that takes out the context of it has to be flexible. It's not saying, don't worry, even if it's rigid, this is good enough. What it's saying is, here is a way of achieving the type of substantial flexibility we're talking about and we're claiming here.
Well, I'm not saying it necessarily displaces the need for the substrate or the chip to be flexible as opposed to rigid. But on top of that, in addition to that normal flexible property, it's saying two other things here you need to be understood to be a substantially flexible circuit layer. One, 50 microns or less. Two, dielectric layer has to be sufficiently low stress. What's wrong with that line of thinking when it says what it says, where it says it at JA16038?
Well, I've already stated that I think this is an example of how to do it. and not a definition. But even if we look at the language you're talking about, it doesn't say it has to be 50 microns or less, for example. I mean, I use the word. It says it just must be sufficiently thin, for example, 50 microns or less. So, again, I would say that this certainly isn't a definition that's saying to be substantially flexible, as we're claiming right here, you need to be 50 microns or less. If you're if we assume your premise that this is a definition, at most it would be saying it just needs to be thin enough so that it can be flexible. It needs to be sufficiently thin. For example, 50 microns or less.
How about the dielectric layer?
I believe that's the same thing. That you need a sufficient you need a dielectric here. I think it was already said, you know, 5 × 10⁸. That's very specific. The specification is not always that specific. It's recommending
the dielectric material used in processing semiconductor material must be sufficiently low stress. Otherwise, substantial flexibility is defeated.
Again,
I don't see a for example there. I don't see an EG there.
Well, I think maybe we were misunderstanding. I was saying, if you are saying that the substantial flexibility is part of the definition, again, the specifics 5 × 10⁸ would be an example of that. So what I'm saying...
pay attention. Judge Chen, I think, is very clearly telling you, doesn't this prosecution history require the dielectric material to be low stress? Haven't you disclaimed anything other than low stress dielectric because you say it must be sufficiently low stress, otherwise substantial flexibility is defeated? Isn't that a disclaimer of anything other than low stress dielectric material?
And my response was, I don't think this is a clear enough definition in the context of everything else that's been said, but that if
okay,
it...
What else has been said about low stress?
That it that is...
Patton says it should be low stress, that it distinguishes negatively high stress materials.
Correct.
And that it tells you low stress ideas can, you can understand what we mean by low stress by looking at this patent, which we incorporate by reference. So what else? I don't understand where there's anything at all in this entire record that supports the idea that the dielectric can be anything other than low stress material.
My point was, if you're just looking at substantially flexible, there are numerous claims throughout that are challenged that claim something that's both substantially flexible circuit, and then further requires it have the low stress dielectric.
This is the claim differentiation argument.
Exactly.
Right?
So I'm saying in the context of those, for example, I think that makes it clear that those are not
Are you saying that prosecution history statements can never render terms and claims redundant?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying that to be a special definition and a special disavowal, there needs to be a very clear intent and there needs to be a clear definition. And the point was, if you look at the context of the rest of the intrinsic record, I think that sheds light on this not being such a special definition, not a clear intent to specially define it to require these things.
You keep saying that, but you've pointed to nothing else in the record that contradicts the fact that this is a clear definition. You keep saying words, but you don't actually point us to any evidence.
Well, I was talking about...
Let me point you to 15404, which is, for me, the strongest passage on the dielectric. Although, you know, defeated is a pretty compelling word, and I don't have anything equally as good. But at 15404, you have note the flexible circuit layer must possess a low stress dielectric in order for it to be flexible. And how do you say that's not a clear statement? You don't think that's a clear statement?
My point was, I think that's inconsistent with the claims that require both those limitations. But to go back,
so your only argument to the contrary is the claim differentiation argument. You don't have anything in the prosecution history or the spec to point to that would suggest that you didn't mean to limit yourself to low stress dielectric.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Right.
So we're on the same page. JA10314. There's a statement that says, for a circuit layer to be substantially flexible, comma, applicant has found that the dielectric layer must have low tensile stress. That was in your remarks section for another office action response. J JA10314.
And I think, again, if those are definitions, if you're taking the position that those are definitions, our main point was, well, I think there's three points if I could make those. The main point is that's not reading out the flexibility aspect of substantially flexible, which was what was tried to be, which was part of the problem below.
But regardless, your argument is there's a fact-finding made by the board on motivation to combine and reasonable expectation of success regarding to exactly this limitation, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. So if I could just, the other two points I wanted to make, each of the passages that you're referring to as the definition are talking about thinning in general and low stress dielectric in general without putting a specific number or requiring a specific number such as 50 microns or less or the 10 times 8. So again, our main point is
5 times 10 to the 8th. I'm sorry, but I have to correct you.
I'm sorry.
Not 10 times 8, that would just be 80.
Thank you, Your Honor. But that those numbers shouldn't be part of any construction of substantially flexible. Our main point is the findings of fact under any of these constructions compel an affirmance of the validity of these claims.
Is there anything further? I'm going to restore some rebuttal time to Mr. Cordell. So to keep it fair, if there's anything else you felt like you needed to cover, I'll give you a little extra time to do it. You don't have to. It's like an ugly sweater contest. You don't have to enter.
Sometimes I enter without realizing I am.
Right.
I just want to make sure that we're clear. There was no agreement of the experts that there's no ordinary meaning of substantially flexible. Their expert explained exactly what's needed to be substantially flexible. So that was said a number of times. We addressed the prosecution history indefiniteness in the court, in the briefing, as did the board. And I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay, very good. Mr. Cordell, we'll give you 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
So first, to finish out the discussion we were having before, our discussion of obviousness under the appellee's claim construction is limited. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And it was best done actually in our opening brief, where at A1521 we summarized the prior art and talked about those features. We then, in our reply brief before the board,
what do you mean limited? Non-existent?
It exists, but it requires some sleuthing, Your Honor. I want to be as candid as I can about that. So we do summarize the prior art. We go through the features that we say are common to both the prior art and the disclosed invention, not even the claimed invention. At 1800 in volume 3, we make it very clear that we believe that the claim construction pursued by Appellees here, by Elm, is incorrect, and that under a correct construction that in fact the claims are obvious. So I want to make that just eminently clear. With respect to the claim differentiation argument, we certainly believe that the prosecution history trumps anything
But you got to take the bull by the horns here, Mr. Cordell. What is wrong with his argument, which I find very persuasive, which is that even if we import these limitations into this definition, the board has expressly reached, for example, fact findings related to the low stress material, motivation to combine a reasonable expectation of success, because all but, I guess, it's 8 of the claims had that expressly. So what's left? Why isn't that an affirmance?
Well, because I think the board's findings there are flawed. So maybe I should spend a moment addressing that. So the evidence the board relied upon to make those findings had to do with this distinction between the front end of line and back end of line processing. The way the evidence unfolded is that Elm's expert pointed to all of the difficulties in processing these dielectrics in the front end of line because the temperatures are high, the purity requirements are very high. And said that that's why the evidence doesn't show the motivation to combine, doesn't show the likelihood of success. We took the opposite position, that in fact these are back end of line. And I can show you excerpts of Burton where they actually talk about these dielectrics being grown after the metal layer is imposed. So by definition, we are at the back end of line. What the board did is rather than resolve those disputes, they said we just don't have to. And so we're just, they intimated that they were going to accept our view of the world, that these were done at back end of line, but then credited the evidence from Elm that these things were done in the front end of line. So there was a conflict in the evidence, and for that reason alone, I think that we need to remand it back to the board and get them to sort that out.
There's a conflict in the evidence on a fact-finding that they made. That doesn't usually screen remand.
It's not a conflict in the evidence, in the issues. It's a conflict in their process, Your Honor. So this is challenging for me. The evidence they rely on is the suggestion that these are done in front end of line. That's the evidence they rely on. But then they also say that they're going to assume that it's back end of line. And they don't explain the gap. So under Chenery, they've got to tell us why they made the decision they made. And if they decide that our evidence is no good, or they're going to side with Elm on the front end of line versus back end of line debate, that would be one thing. But they didn't do that. So there's a gap in their analysis, a significant gap that undermines that fact finding.
Okay. I thank both counsel. The case is taken under submission.